Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival's Writer to Writer podcast series, featuring a conversation between two prominent writers who are big fans of each other's work. This is Sherilyn Parsons, director of the festival. Enjoy the program.
Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival's Writer to Writer conversation between Morgan Parker and Ishmael Reed. I'm Ishmael Muhammad, the reviews editor at The Believer magazine. Please, before we start the conversation, turn on the volume or turn off your cell phones. I want to acknowledge our sponsors for today, Zoetic Press. Without them, this event wouldn't be possible. I'm going to begin by introducing our writers today, and then they're going to read from their most recent works, Magical Negro and Conjugating Hindi. Then I'll have some conversations or questions for them, and we'll get the conversation started. So, Ishmael Reed, I feel like needs no introduction, but I'll do it anyway. He's the author of novels, plays, poetry, and nonfiction. He has received prizes in every category. His 1972 novel, Mumbo Jumbo, has been cited by Harold Bloom as one of the 500 great books of the Western canon. He's received the Otto and Odelko Awards for theater. In 1998, he received the John D. MacArthur Genius Award. He is one of a handful of authors to be nominated for two National Book Awards within the same year. A songwriter whose songs have been recorded by Gregory Porter, Cassandra Wilson, Macy Gray, and Taj Mahal, Reed is also a musician whose piano playing was cited by Harper's Bazaar and Vogue as he accompanied a 2019 fashion show featuring the work of fashion designer Grace Wells Bonner. His poem, Just Rollin' Along, about the 1934 encounter between Bonnie and Clyde and Oakland blues artist L.C. Good Rockin' Robinson, will be included in the Best American Poetry 2019. His poetry has appeared in the New Yorker, the Paris Review, and the New York Times. Please welcome Ishmael Reed. And Morgan Parker also needs no introduction, I think, but I'll do it. Morgan Parker is the author of the poetry collection Magical Negro. There are more beautiful things than Beyonce, and other people's comfort keeps me up at night. Her debut young adult novel, Who Put This Song On, is forthcoming in late 2019, and her debut book of nonfiction will be released in 2020. Her poetry and essays have appeared in Tin House, The Paris Review, The Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip Hop, Best American Poetry 2016, The New York Times, and The Nation. She hosts Reparations Live. I love that. Co-curates the Poets with Attitude reading series with Tommy Pico. And with Angel Nafis, she is the Other Black Girl Collective. She lives in Los Angeles. Please welcome Morgan Parker. So we'll begin with a few readings. Let's start with Morgan.
Hello. Good to see y'all. There's lots of folks here. Who were Frederick Douglass's cousins and other quotidian black history facts I wish I learned in school? I have a body. It sits in a desk. Every day is bitten with new guilt. My teacher can see right through me all the way to Black History Month. It is my fortune to be ashamed and from nowhere. How can I concentrate on photosynthesis when there is a thing called Africa? When my teacher talks about slaves, I become a slave. I know too much. I raise my hand. American flag and family tree. Is it my fault my stomach aches? I wait in my desk and try to be still. I lie and immediately confess. I grew a plant in a paper towel. I get in trouble for talking. At recess, I pretend. The mountains are closing in. I am good, but too curious. What happened to the Indians? How do we know about heaven and dragonflies? Where did Harriet Tubman sleep? Who did Harriet Tubman kiss? What about the Africans that stayed? Why are they hungry? Did Frederick Douglass's mother brush his hair in the morning? Was he tender-headed and afraid? Is this how I'm supposed to feel? Are you sure? How do you know?
Is the mic on? Okay. I don't know where we're supposed to read, so I won't stumble through this without my glasses. I have a group called the Digitalites. Had already named the store the Brooklyn Bakery, as though we needed another Brooklyn. I happen to like Brooklyn, home of the Rome Neal family. Our Brooklyn is okay where it is. There's also a new restaurant called the Big Apple. The Malins were like those who participated in the invasion of North America, who replaced the Native Americans' names with place names that connected them to their European hometowns. The current president, Kleiner Fuhrer, had restored the invader's name for Mount Denali to Mount McKinley, named for a president whose only accomplishment was getting himself murdered in Buffalo. College Avenue, the Elmwood District's main drag, resembled Greenwich Village on a Saturday night, with bumper-to-bumper traffic, cars full of millennials, much name for millennials, okay. Made it up. Downtown chic restaurants and bars had replaced the older ones. No more Hofbräu, Esther's Orbit Room, where the Oakland Blues was born, shut down. Paranoid Ishmael Reed once wrote a poem. I get called that a lot. William Burroughs said that the paranoid man is the one with all the facts. Okay. Paranoid Ishmael Reed once wrote a poem about New York following him around. Quote, like a West Side meat packing house that will barter your heart for ice. End of quote. He was talking about relocating to California from New York, a refugee from the New York 1960s. Now Oakland was beginning to look like Queens. But next to the early period of Oakland, this amounted to an inconvenience. Yes, the Black Panthers come into criticism because they were infiltrated by criminals and white armchair revolutionaries from the East who wanted to manipulate them as one would characters in a video game. But given Oakland's legacy, the arrival of an armed black defense organization was inevitable. Looking at Oakland of today, it's hard to imagine that the KKK once ruled City Hall and burned crosses in Temescal Regional Park, which nowadays resembles the peaceable kingdom as Hispanic, Black, Asian, and Euro-American picnickers gather there. It was a symbolic that the Malins lived in a district named after the elm tree. The elm tree had been wiped out by Dutch disease, and for the Malins, the Black Civil Rights Movement was also dead. It had been co-opted by something called intersectionality, which only should be done on a case-to-case basis. I think that's my opinion. Okay. The only group that seems to have benefited from the movement was white women. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor gave blacks a 20-year deadline for black affirmative action. Were women, she required 50%. There were over 50% in college enrollment, a movement that had once been as strong as the eucalyptus. In fact, the tree that was mentioned in the song, like a tree standing by the water, must have been a eucalyptus tree. Now, the Digitalites had reached North Oakland, where Boa now lived. Boa is the nickname of the character, leading character, gets all the lines. We all grew up on Wonder Bread, the Wonder Bread factory that was located on Adeline Street was now Bakery Lofts. That was in another sign of gentrification, a coffee shop opened around the corner from his house. and, of course, dogs. One invader, a tall, shorts-wearing blonde, walked through his neighborhood with a bloodhound on a leash. Given the historical relationship between bloodhounds and blacks, this was an insult to the new blacks, the few blacks remaining, whether she was aware or not. Tech sites like Pandora and Ask already had been located in Oakland, and Google was said to be scouring Oakland's naval yard for an office. Like that Delhi masterpiece, Jaspar Chatterjee's poem, Delhi Metro. Yes, like the Metro introduced modernity to India, but however clear it might be, it could not insulate the city from stray cows and maddening crowds. Bay Area rapid transit could not insulate its riders from blacks living among the garbage at the 27th Street exit of 880. Like Delhi, gentrified Oakland and Berkeley had undergone a sleek uptown makeover with new restaurants, theaters, boutiques, but couldn't hide the misery of those who had been left behind. All that the digitalites from San Francisco and New York knew about the 60s was that it introduced some strains of Buddhism, yoga, microbiotic food, white middle class women's rights. I'm going to get it, huh? Let me do the question and answer period. Their hero wasn't Malcolm X, it was Alice Waters. And the successors. I see a lot of ads in the East Bay for food. And the successor to the underground newspapers, alternative newspapers that have been swallowed up by big chains, devoted whole supplements to where to eat. Nothing about the 40 million who had little or nothing at all to eat. And what would happen to the dwellers in Jerry towns if an earthquake hit? Where would they find food, water, and sanitation? Remember Hoovervilles? Anybody old enough to remember Hoovervilles? Okay, we have Jerry towns. People living under it. On 45th Street, you can see all those people that are living out there. Okay. Californians were in a perpetual state of anxiety over the 8-point earthquake that would arrive within the next 30 years or another cataclysmic fire. The film San Andreas about the fault, which would generate a 9.5 earthquake, gave Boa nightmares. You never knew when one would hit. In fact, some were predicting that the Hayward Fault and the San Andreas Fault might erupt at the same time. Even scarier was a report from PBS Novus, which showed the left side and the right side of the San Andreas Fault moving away from each other at the rate of two inches per year. When the Pacific and the North American tectonic plates grounded past each other, you didn't want to be around. That's why Californians are always on pins and needles. Moreover, California's always been a guest in North America, having originated in South America. It is a geological freak. Here you find soil, plant life, minerals, and fossils not found in the rest of the United States. You didn't want to be around when California decided to relocate, maybe ending up in the Pacific. Suppose that geological California decided to go home.
Thank you both for that, for those great readings. So I want to begin the conversation by just asking how you two encounter one another's work, not just as writers, obviously, but as kind of institution builders. Ishmael, of course, founded the Before Columbus Foundation, which has been crucial for so many POC writers, and Morgan herself runs the other Black Road Collective and the reading series with Tommy Pico. So I'm curious about how you guys got to know one another's work and how you've engaged with one another's work.
Ishmael Reed. I mean, I don't know when I first encountered, but I really, it it takes a lot for me to kind of latch on to someone's entire kind of career, especially across genres. But you're funny. And I like funny people, you know, and I also have a, you know, a little rebel in me as well. And I just really appreciate when folks are honest and sort of rude and funny, but true and unafraid in this way. And I think I really, I was telling you earlier, I like don't believe in time. And so I'm always thinking about that. And that's one thing that really drew me to your work is this kind of like irreverence about time and progression or, you know, whatever we in America refer to as that. So yeah. And also to see that played out in the novels, but also in poems and the way that Neo-Hoodism, the way that you're speaking kind of across generations. And I think that's how I understand blackness. So that's something that has always connected me to Ishmael's work.
Yeah, well, I got your Magical Negro, I think, on the Kindle. I started that way. And then they sent me a couple of books. And there are a lot of brilliant lines in your work, a lot of originality. Not only do you speak from particulars, but also there's universal stuff in there. And I could see that you well-read. I recognize some of Shange's licks, you know, in Tozaki. Mm-hmm. Probably somebody you've read. Mm-hmm. So I think that black women's writing is flourishing. I think the problem is they only hear about one or two.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on a panel with two very famous writers, women writers, and I said, you know, the average black woman writer I know is broke, or they have to, you know, work other jobs. One of the most brilliant postmodernist writers lives here in Berkeley. She's homeless. We published her book, didn't get a single review. I just sent it. I'm trying to get Glenda Capio at Harvard to do something about it. But
who is that author?
I don't want to mention it, but I mean, you know, I have her books I could send to you. But she wrote a classic in the 1960s where she combined images of the story of the civil rights movement with the Orpheus legend. So she's a very brilliant person. So this is something that happens in marketing in the East where you think there's a big explosion in black women's writing when I can name dozens of them who are as good as anyone who is being pushed by this New York elite that's been giving us tokens for 100 years. This is 100th anniversary. You know, they usually create a token and then they replace them when they rear up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very difficult for me to tell people that there were a lot of good writers around when James Baldwin was writing. I think a lot of people saw him on television. They don't know his history. But there was Chester Himes, who's now, his novel, Let Him Holler, or If He Hollers, is considered like the Los Angeles novel by critics. Yeah. And then there were women like Margaret Walker. I would say that Margaret Walker's Jubilee is probably in contention for being the great American novel.
Yeah.
Oh, she was writing at the time, but she didn't live in New York. She lived in Mississippi. So like a penalty. I'll just end by saying that we've tried to provide alternative institutions so that a full range of the American experience and the diversity can be recognized instead of this clique that's been, you know, running things for since Claude McKay. Claude McKay was the token at that time in the 1920s. And then when he broke with the downtown left-wing establishment, he was useless. He was no longer praised, celebrated by them. He ended up joining the Catholic Church. So then we had Baldwin, who's an excellent writer. We read Baldwin for story. We read Amiri Baraka for technique, and Shange and people like that for technique, because they were taking us to a different place. But he had to work his way up by being a hatchet man. And if you want to read more about that, You can read my introduction to Charles Wright's HarperCollins bring out Charles Wright's three books. Charles Wright's The Whig, Absolutely Nothing to Get Alarmed About, and The Messenger. And he sort of like didn't want fame. And, Baldwin had to hit, like, he had to hit Chester Himes. He had to hit Langston Hughes. He had to turn on his benefactors. He had to go to Paris and put down, you know, African and American writers, African-American writers and African writers. So he had to really work his way up to the top to win favor of the Protestant. You know, all know about the Protestant view? Yeah, the Protestant view sort of ran things. So they're the ones who did that hit on Richard Wright, everybody's protest novel.
Oh, yeah.
And that's because William Phillips of the Protestant view had problems with Richard Wright. He was in Paris living too well. He wasn't patriotic enough and all this kind of stuff, so he put his job. So then, I'm just telling this because I teach it. Okay. So then he writes, tell me how long the train's been gone. How many people read that book? Well, just a handful. Okay. That's when he broke with his sponsors. Okay. Because he thumbed his nose at them. You know. He had a difficult time with Lee Strasberg of Actors Studio. They messed up his play. They messed up his play so he wanted to commit suicide. Okay? He threatened to commit suicide. He couldn't use words like motherfucker in there. They said, no, you can't be, you know. So he took revenge on them. He took revenge on his sponsors. Okay? Terrible, I mean, really scathing satires of Lee Strasberg and Actors Theater and everything. And so after that, he was persona non grata among the New York crowd. As a matter of fact, we published a piece by Truman Capote. Al Young and I published a piece in a magazine called Yardbird, where Truman Capote said they were treating Baldwin like shit. So what they do, they went and got somebody else. They got Eldridge Cleaver. I'm sorry for the rant, but that's sort of like... But the point is that, you know, you have to create alternative institutions so they don't leave. The problem with tokenism is it stifles variety.
Right.
Okay.
That's the thing. It's tokenism then becomes censorship.
Absolutely.
You know, and you
Absolutely.
Feel like you have to write
Absolutely.
For everyone yeah. or you can't step on to. I mean, I know you don't give a shit yeah. about this, but neither do I. You yeah. know, and yeah. I think that's... it's rare,
yeah.
and there's all, you know, folks are always, like, warning me
yeah.
to, like, not talk about this, or to say things in a gentler way, or, you know,
well,
whatever. But that's, and that is the danger.
Well, you can't be a token because you live in Los Angeles.
That's right. It's true.
They think
they don't know what to do with
they
California
think
blacks.
West of the Rockies is like cactus and people with surfboards, and, you know, so they don't pay much attention to what goes out here, what goes on out here.
Let's talk a bit about history, because Morgan brought up the question of time. Obviously, like neo-hoodoo has been kind of influential for many black writers in the generation after Ishmael's been working. Can you say a bit about like your conception of time and black history and how you're both like writing into black history and like what's at stake when you kind of write about black history in either your poetry or your prose?
I mean, same old, right? And so I think the way that I experience the world is that, you know, we're here on this plane, but you can also see just so many echoes of the past and what we refer to as the past and, you know, civil rights history and the legacy of slavery, you know, like things like that. I think that does us no good to disconnect past from present. And to not see forward into the future and to not understand that all those things are happening at once. What we do in the past, you know, is reflected in the present and the future. And what we're doing now is creating the future, building the ground for it to stand on. And I think, you know, America's just like a weird place that's in this weird cycle where it's I don't know, I think about your work and it's like there's technology but then there's like a slave owner, and I think that's how that is a particular and a very black way of seeing the world, because it's same-o, same-o. And it's just all kind of repeating. It might look different, you know, to some folk, but what's, you know, really what is the difference between a slave owner and, you know, a trader? So I think that, yeah, that's kind of how I think about the, I always say, like, I'm halfway on a slave ship all the time. And there's like a way in which, you know, like there's a bodily memory and psychologically we're able to hold all these different planes of time. That's kind of what I think. My therapist is like, what the fuck? She's like, okay, but you're in this room, right?
And Ishmael, can you speak a bit to, I mean, because a book like Flight to Canada or Mumbo Jumbo is very much kind of working along the lines that Morgan just outlined. Can you speak a bit about how Neo-Hoodoo, where the idea came from, and how you were drawing from kind of your own literary ancestors and you concocted that idea?
Well, I wrote this manifesto in Los Angeles, which is really a bigger rant than you heard from, you know, previously. And it became some kind of like multi-million-dollar project. And Yale University published a book entitled The Neo-Hoodoo. And there was this very expensive show that started at the Malin Gallery. What is it called? Manil. Thanks. My copy editor. Manil Gallery in Houston, and traveled to New York and got written up the Times and everything. But that was a primitive search for a lost religion. What I want to say is that, you know, I never thought that a work of mine would be discussed on The View. And the discussion, I never thought that the discussion on The View would be more sophisticated than the work being discussed on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is like supposed to be a nerdy show. But I spent $1,000 opposing a $100 million a year project called Hamilton. And I never thought it would generate this kind of controversy, where I got a lot of name calling and comments in the New York Times, you know, the comment section, there are 200 calling me like illiterate, semi-literate, and jealous. And one woman said, you know, you're better off here than in Africa.
You know, I love when they say that.
I had a great time in Africa. I said, not once was I followed in a department store in Africa. So, but it's generated quite a controversy. But speaking of history, I'm challenging the history of Hamilton. This, what I call the biggest consumer fraud since the Blair Witch Project. So the point is that they're trying to portray Hamilton as an abolitionist when he was in slave trading business from the time of his youth. When he was a youth in the Caribbean, his job was to groom the slaves for auction, which is like, you know, my daughter Tennessee says, like grooming a dog for a dog show. And then he married into this terrible Dutch family, the Schuylers. They're trying to portray on, I don't know if you've seen the musical, but I had to forego the mortgage.
Yeah.
Because they were saying, well, you haven't seen, huh? You know? I said, well, I haven't seen King Lear either, but I know how the story goes. I read the book. You know? So in the musical, they portray these sisters, these party girls, Elizabeth and Angelica, who owned a slave, as abolitionists. I don't know. So, they've had to backtrack, as a matter of fact, because I spent $1,000 investment on this thing. And so they sent one of their spies the first night of the reading. This is just a tacky reading. You know, people reading the scripts, they're stumbling over the lines and everything. So she got up and asked me, had I seen the musical? That was the line in the New York Times and other places. I finally saw it. I wrote a piece in the Chronicle about seeing it. And turns out that she's on a payroll. Hamilton, I mean, they're building this museum now dedicated to Hamilton. But all those people, yeah, in Long Island, wouldn't you know? But all those people were involved in the slave trade. And Hamilton married into the Schuyler family, and Elizabeth, his wife, helped her mother manage the slaves. So they found, these are what he called bioanthropologists, found the bones of the slaves who served the Schuylers, and found that they had suffered from malnutrition. They were subjected to, back-breaking work, and treated harshly. Then I went to went to research in Albany, and I found that the Schuyler family had, and other Dutch families, have presided over the lynching of two black teenagers, even. So I've gotten more research. Matter of fact, my director said, why they let him in there? Because even after seeing the musical, I even got more facts. But if you want to see the play, it opens in New York on May 23rd at the New Eureka Poets Cafe. But this is the idea of one of the roles, not the role I wouldn't impose this upon anybody, but this is one of the tasks of the black writers of the past, is that they challenge the official history. Mm-hmm. So, after the Civil War, Frederick Douglass challenged this cult around Robert E. Lee. I mean, you all know Civil War history, that the Southerners at the time blamed him for losing the war. Okay, did you know that? That this asshole went into Gettysburg because he thought that because of the draft riots in New York, these Irish guys didn't want to, fight another person's war in conscription, that the North was, becoming favorable to the Southern cause. And if you read my new book, Why No Confederate Statues in Mexico, you'll find that, these guys practiced, they went to sort of like massacre school in Mexico. Stonewall Jackson was down there. Jefferson Davis was down there. All these generals, Confederate generals down there. And they slaughtered thousands of Mexican people. And I have on the cover some cadets who defied Robert E. Lee. Some kids, 13 to 16, who refused to surrender in the face of Robert E. Lee and these Southern generals. And fought them. They were slaughtered. And one of these Mexican kids jumped off the ledge of this castle, this fortress, embracing the Mexican flag. And there's nothing you don't know. St. Patrick's Battalion. It's Irish Americans who had invaded Mexico with the Northern invasion, James Polk's war. They slaughtered so many Mexicans that this Irish American battalion, there were blacks included in this battalion, they defected and joined the Mexicans, and they were hanged for treason. So what I'm telling you is there's a backstory that these guys down there saying, the Jews will not replace us, and all this junk, who have been indoctrinated with this curriculum, this poisonous curriculum. These people don't know what happened before the Civil War, where these people massacred Native Americans, they massacred blacks, okay? So one more thing. Hamilton, the criticism of Hamilton is that he was a slaver, and nothing can change that history. Matter of fact, he left receipts. he left where he sold slaves, right? So I went to a Native American blog, and the Native Americans said, well, they don't even mention us. And that Hamilton, they don't mention the policy of Hamilton and Washington toward Native Americans was extermination. I guess red lives don't matter. I mean, why would black lives matter? Red lives don't matter either. And so I found a letter written by Hamilton in 1793 where he congratulates a vigilante mob that went into a Native American settlement and killed every man, woman, and child. Okay, so I think I have a good cause, even though, people are criticizing.
But that's because everyone wants to get behind something and overlook the problems just for the sake of, well, at least there's some, at least there's, diversity or whatever the fuck people are talking about. I think, and that's not fair. That's not.
But I think black lives didn't matter in 17th century. Black lives don't matter now.
Oh, no.
I mean, the police.
It has to be a question.
I think the majority of whites believe that we have a very good relationship with the police. You know, we have them over for tea and all this. So, you know, they don't know what we go through with the police. So Black Lives, the pilgrims came here and decided that the Native Americans were beasts. And that's still the mentality that we have in the White House. This fool in the White House, every time I see that Andrew Jackson portrait, I cringe.
Yeah.
Because this guy was like the Himmler of Native American policy and went down into Spanish territory, which is where Florida was. It was Spanish territory there. Went down there and wiped out a fortress called the Negro Fort, which was sort of like a communal society participated in by Native Americans and blacks. He went down and destroyed it. He said, because these free Negroes will give these enslaved Negroes ideas. So they have that guy up in the White House, his portrait.
But then, so just to touch on the question of Black Lives Mattering, I wonder if like another like use of this kind of writing into history is not just about kind of correcting the record, but also about kind of trying to like create a sense of humanity or like search for our black humanity where other people have like left that out of the record. I ask you to read You're Who Were Frederick Douglass's Cousin's poem, because that last stanza, where did Harriet Tubman sleep, who did Harriet Tubman kiss, is so powerful, because it asks us to think about her as not, you know, the icon, but as an actual woman.
Yep.
who loved and was loved. So, and I, that's a kind of...
And carried a gun and had narcolepsy. Yeah. And just was, you know, like a full person. And not an old lady for her whole life.
Well,
I mean, you know, it's like, they just found that one picture. That's the one I got tattooed because they found her young. Like, she looks young. She's a babe.
I got one.
But, yeah, but, you know, and I'm like, she's not wearing a shawl all the time. You know? And I, you know, I was talking about this in my... Part of, you know, in my young adult is this trying to figure out what your history is when you haven't been told these things. And there's a part where it's like, oh, like, she's always wearing a staff. Like, she's always, like, she's actually Moses. Like, white people just take everything so literally. it's such an erasure, and it is violent. And I think people don't understand it that way. It's like, oh, well, we just wrote it wrong. But that's violent. That hurts. And even the question of, like, does your life matter? Like, that's despicable, you know, that has to be a question or a statement or whatever. And I think part of, like, correcting the record is, like, not correcting it, just, like, rewriting it in our own terms. Because the question is, like, who wrote that history and for whom, you know? Yeah, I think, I mean, here are all these other stories of America that could be written and haven't been. So there's a lot more.
That's what the Puerto Rican student said to Miranda when he went to Puerto Rico. I don't know if you read the Times. The Puerto Rican students, when Lin-Manuel Miranda went to Puerto Rico, boycotted him. Mm. And he said, you are just glorifying an oppressor, and you should write a musical about Harriet Tubman. Now, I can't get people in the classes where I teach. I can't get them to come to some kind of thing like that. They love the dancing and the singing, you see. But, I mean, that was the response he got there. I have Harriet Tubman in my play, and she approaches Mnuchin about keeping her off that bill, the $10 bill.
No, she doesn't want to be on that.
I said she should be on a dollar bill. People, her followers don't have $10 bills to wave around. But, you know, is he the Secretary of Treasury, Mnuchin? He's keeping her off the bill. And it's because of this Hamilton fraud that they're keeping Alexander Hamilton on. So, you know. But Harry Tubman was not compensated by the government. She delivered 300 slaves from bondage. And... worked in these hospitals where she not only healed Confederate soldiers, but Union soldiers. So she contributed greatly to the government. And Secretary Seward, at the time, tried to give her compensation. So she was poor.
She died poor, I think.
And she could raise money. Like, she'd call up people and say, God told me you had some money for me. And that's how she financed, you know, these forays into the South. But now she's being humiliated again by the Secretary of Treasury.
So as you can all tell, these two are very funny. I want to ask a question about humor as a kind of like mode of like shade as a mode of critique. Like, how do you think humor is useful in kind of like loving a critique that people can't simply like laugh off or ignore? And I ask this question because I saw you read Morgan in Portland at AWP, and you read from the you read from the Matt poem.
Okay.
Yeah. And do you want to tell that story?
You can.
Okay. So if you've read the book, there's a poem called Matt, which is kind of like litany of various white men.
M-A-T-T, Matt?
M-A-T-T.
Excellent piece, yeah.
Who go by the name Matt. And the audience was like, oh, that's like so sad. And Morgan was like, no, fuck that.
I always have to read that in like very white. I mean, Portland. I was like, literally, I'm looking at 15 Matts. And their faces were like falling while I was reading it. Like, they're like, oh, is this me? Like, you know, it's like, it almost does take a joke. I'm like, it's a joke. It's ridiculously funny. Because it's so, like, I understand them more than they understand themselves, sort of thing. And I think that's, you know, that is humor. And that is a very black humor that started, you know, with our, you know, side eyes at each other on the plantation. Like, that is really, we've always had this, like, separate undercover, like, secret joke, you know? And I don't know. Reading that in Portland was, it was tough because we were, like,
funny.
Up on a stage
where
I can look and see people. And I would say little things like, oh, Matt knows he's part of the problem. And their faces are like, they were so upset. And they're like, you know, they're laughing. And then all of a sudden, they're not laughing. And that is like my favorite moment in the whole world. You know, you're thinking it's one thing. And then we can swerve at the end and talk about slavery. It's like, it's just like, you know, I think it's effective.
Yeah, so that was the funny thing about that was that, you know, I could see in their faces they were kind of having a good time, like kind of consuming this blackness. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you were like, no, that's not what's happening. So can we just like...
And it's not for you. Like, I'm not here to entertain you. You think so, you know, but that's... You have to go home and reckon with yourself after this.
So, Tommy, do you guys, like, think about... Sorry for interrupting.
No. But
do you guys, like, think about humor as being, like, a way to, like, inflict discomfort on audiences who would, like, try to just consume blackness as if it were this easy aesthetic thing?
Well, I don't think mainstream critics find my humor very funny. Otherwise, you know, New York Times wouldn't have ignored my last five books. So they called me up last year and they said, we want you to come to New York and be in this supplement we're doing, or this magazine we're doing about the resurgence of black male authors, right? So I said, I can't make it. Then they call again. So I said, why do you consider me a part of the resurgence when you guys haven't, you know, reviewed my last five books? And they said, well, that's another department. So I find myself on the cover of the New York Times magazine section. Okay, that's fine. But I think that I was left as literary roadkill because I didn't like the Color Purple movie. Okay, that's what happened. I boycotted because I don't like Steven Spielberg's interpretation of Alice Walker's novel, The Color Purple, and it's hard to determine which scenes Steven Spielberg put in there and which come from the original book. And she didn't like it either. But I mean, they see people's movie stuff. You know, she said in Seven in the Same River Twice or whatever. She didn't like it.
Right,
she didn't like it either because. What these white male patriarchs do, and you see them all in trouble in Hollywood for sexual harassment, they take the images of the blacks and make them worse and exaggerate them more. So, I mean, that was a problem with that film. So I got boycotted. I said, wow, how do you sustain a career if you alienate powerful
American critics, you know, Eurocentrics, I use a small e, lowercase Europe, because they don't know Europe either. They think of Europe, they think about England and France, or Paris. But I mean, I've been to Europe many times. I started going to Europe when I was 17. It's quite different from what this overseas settler colony sees Europe as. But anyway, I said, how do I get out of there? I studied Japanese. I wrote a novel called Japanese by Sprint. The Chinese government is paying for this novel to be studied in Chinese schools. So what happened with this novel here, Conjugating Hindi? My last novel, Juice, they hate that book about the O.J. trial, which drove these people crazy. They're still in recovery. They're still in recovery over that, man.
Listen, Los Angeles can't.
They can't get over
it. Like, it's like something happened. They lost
I got
mind.
An O.J. alert. And there's something on there every day about O.J., you know? So this is the consensus. This is the consensus around my work among American Eurocentric critics. I've gone too far. That's what the guy said. I've gone too far. You like the Paterolas? I mean, if you left the plantation, you'd have to have a note or something. They'll tell you you've gone too far. So I said, well, how do I do this? So I wrote Japanese by Spring, got a great tour of Japan, great reviews and everything, and then the Chinese picked it up. And, you know, the best review I got on Juice, which was not covered here, was from China. So I studied Hindi for about 9 months with a private tutor. And the best reviews of this new book have come from Pakistani and Indian critics. So you don't have to get along with people that, you know, you don't have to go be screened or filtered or whatever or toned down or, you know, redeem them. It's James Baldwin. That's why they like James. He said, I'm going to redeem you, white preacher. And he got sick of redeeming in the redeeming business. And by the time he wrote How Long the Train's Been Gone, he said the most comfortable place he found in the United States was a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco. Okay? So I tell younger writers, become global. Mm-hmm. You understand? Become global. Because they're never going to get it right here. You know, like that Matt in your poem. He reads white guys. He reads white literature.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. We're always going to be marginalized here.
And he writes it.
He writes it.
You know, like everyone he reads is white, and he's writing a novel. You know, like that's it is the perpetual thing, and it'll always be.
Yeah, I think so.
Since the beginning.
I think you're right.
Juice, by the way, though, was so funny.
Well, a lot of people didn't find it funny.
So because this is a conversation between generations, I'm wondering what, say, our generation has learned from Ishmael's generation. Either like
that was like 100 years ago, my friend.
just yesterday. Either like have what have we learned to emulate, and what have we learned to kind of avoid, kind of via like just watching mistakes that have been made. And I'm curious about what, you know, Ishmael, you're learning by watching younger writers do their work today.
Well, I like your Beyonce work in there. I saw Beyonce on the show. I guess I have a generation gap here because my students tell me about people I don't know, singers and stuff. I saw a show where she's like turning her fanny to the audience for about 20 minutes. You know, waving her fanny at the audience for about 20 minutes. Then they put up a sign that said feminism.
Yes,
So I said, wait a minute. How's this feminism?
And then Chimamanda's some reason.
But she lost me when she sang Ave Maria.
Permission, I guess. I mean, I would say that my generation, we're way more comfortable with going too far. And that's really something. And, you know,
I see in your work.
Oh, yeah. I went too far. Yeah. I mean, but we feel, and my peers support me in that. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, you've made this way and also taught us how to do that and remain to like stick by what you're talking about and not be like, oh, you're right. Maybe I should. Oh, let me correct this.
Yeah, you take a lot of risk in there.
And I think that's it's really important to have that example. And I think that's something that across our generation of writers that we're really thinking about and like committed to. There is still a little bit of this only a couple of us can make it sort of thing, but that's something I have a lot of conversations about, and I think we're trying to get a little bit better about that. And that also has to do with everyone just kind of doing their thing.
You guys are less brutal with each other than we were. I mean, I'm not talking to some of these people. You know, we're so down on each other. So Richard Pryor came through here. Mm-hmm. He came here. When he left here, he's a different person. Because we told him, you can't bring that old Las Vegas stuff up here, old corny stuff that you do down there in Las Vegas, in the nightclubs and things. You better change. So he changed. And we always believed that in comic aggression, you know, which is like probably the favorite technique of the masses of people, if you look at the Tulsa. Mm-hmm. Hip-hop comes out. Hip-hop didn't begin 20, 30 years ago in the Bronx. This is a long tradition, 19th century. I studied Yoruba, an African language. You can trace it back to West Africa, all the boasting and posturing and all that.
Storytelling.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, we try to change things, but I think we are brutal to each other.
And that didn't help.
I've been in so-called poetry workshops where fistfights broke out.
Yeah, that's, so, we don't need all that.
So, you know... You didn't like that poem, man?
It ain't that serious. It's truly not. We got bigger things to do, like rewrite history.
That's not happening in Berkeley. We don't do that. California has come up a few times now, and I wonder, I'm from Los Angeles. I wonder, like, how you guys think, like, being based in California or, like, moving to California after being, you know, from Buffalo, or coming back to California after spending time in New York, has shaped your writing, and or if there's anything kind of special about being a black writer in New York in comparison to, you know, Chicago or New York.
I think it's lower mortality rate. I lived in New York, and you know, as a matter of fact, I wrote a long piece about black musicians, and what surprised me was that a lot of them died before the age of 40. And I've traveled with jazz musicians, so I can see the kind of conditions that they work under. But I think you can just be loved to death in New York. I said, if I hadn't left New York, I would have died from an overdose of affection. You know, because at that time, in the 60s, if you were black and you had a little talent, you had a couple of poems, you know, you could party with Arthur Miller or all these people. So I said, I want to go to the most barbaric place in the country. So I went to Los Angeles. And finally came up to, you know, Northern California in 1967. But I think it's easier here. Mm-hmm. My neighbors don't care what I do as long as I keep my lawn green. Yep. You know, they don't even know me, what I do. But if you want to read... about 40 years of life in my neighborhood, which when we moved in 1979, was predominantly a black neighborhood. And I wrote My Neighborhood, which has been reprinted a lot of times. So when we moved in there, patriarchs ran it. I mean, you know, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Patriarchs ran my neighborhood. When we moved in. When they all died, the gangs took over. The gangs filled in the vacuum. And so after, you know, we went through a phase during the crack epidemic where there's shootouts on my street, my block. You know, changed, we had these church dwellers and Christians and stable people, and then the gangs took over. And I'd tell my wife and daughter to continue shopping because there's a shootout. And we meet with the police. And I once advised, this is humor, that they bring in one of these white kids from the suburbs who can hit a target 1,000 feet to teach these guys how to shoot. Because they would shoot up the cars and you know, and miss the intended target. So I thought that would be a compromise. You know, if you can just bring some of these kids
in. Get more efficient.
Yeah, right, more efficient. So, I mean, you become frustrated. And so you laugh to keep from crying. You understand? So if you want to read that whole series of My Neighborhood Part 1, My Neighborhood Part 2, it'll be in a forthcoming issue of Willie Hearst III. Have you heard of Willie Hearst III's Alta magazine? That's on the stand. So it's going to be in there.
I also was like, I'm going to die if I don't. And I don't know if it's affection. It's a lot of people. And being a writer there is, it's just a lot. It's a lot. And I needed like a little bit of quiet. It is easier. You know, my neighbors just want, they come over because they want me to move my car. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I mean, it really is. I live like on a cul-de-sac. It's super quiet between like a very large Mexican family and an elderly Chinese couple. And it's the most LA thing, you know, like in the world. It's just very, it's just folks. And yeah, there's more space and less like galas. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like it's like we can actually write.
You can go to a book party every night in New York.
Oh man, I think I would have died by book party. Mm-hmm. That would have been it. But I do think it's different, and it is different. One thing about New York-based black people who are from New York, I never was allowed to be that, even though I was there for like 12 years.
Absolutely.
And you feel that.
Absolutely.
And like there's something special about black people in California. It's like we're a little bit weirdos.
Naive.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little naive.
Yeah. I mean, just in our own, I don't know, that's partly it's the lack of like roots, I guess. You know, I don't know. I was talking to someone from New Orleans and they're like, this is literally the birthplace of mm-hmm. black people. And I'm like, oh, I guess we're like the weird cousins or something. Yeah. But I think there's something that's really intriguing to me about that and that I want to build off of. You know, I think it's good to be a little bit out of the kind of larger group mentality.
You can't get any work done.
Of course not. No, it's so much noise.
Yeah. I just thinking about New Orleans. I was there a while ago, and I was in the Bywater, and just walking around, and there was like a sign that said, "This is the spot where Plessy, Plessy was taken off the train." Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's insane to think about that kind of history is there. We don't really get that in California, at least not African-American history, right? There's a whole other kind of
and it's,
history.
And it's also
here.
Not like, oh, my people have been here since, you know what I mean? Like, that's not.
Yeah, well, you know, there's an artist named Charles Alston, I saw one of his murals. He talks about some of the trades that early black Californians were into. They're in the Pony Express.
Yeah.
They were whalers. As a matter of fact, there's a black whaler's home is still in existence in Oakland. So I had to learn that through a mural.
Plus cowboys?
Cowboys, absolutely.
I think we should save time for questions from the audience. I believe there are microphones.
Well, I'm not going to get it.
There'll be microphones making their way to you. Just raise your hand and somebody will come to you. Please.
I'll only answer questions that end with a question mark.
Yeah, please have actual questions.
It's just like a rule I've had to develop. I reserve the right to say
okay, no. I hear the question. A very controversial book among my white literary friends is Paul Beatty's The Sellout. And I'm just wondering if you guys have read it and whether you liked it or didn't like it. What do you think of The Sellout?
I liked it. I had trouble with it when I started it. But I liked it. It was very ambitious.
I reviewed one of his books, and my criticism was that he punches down. Hmm. You know what I mean? Goes after, you know, people who can't defend themselves. Mm. I think the idea
Which book? Was it this one?
I forgot the book I read.
Okay.
White Boy Shuffle or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
and I like his style. He's an interesting style. Like, I think there are some innovators among the younger novelists, like Whitehead, Coastal Whitehead, mm-hmm. Laval, Victor Laval, mm-hmm. and B. I would put him in that group.
Yeah.
But I think there's a certain kind of humor that goes after the so-called underclass. Hmm. That kind of turns me off. That was my criticism of that book.
I think that's what... Well, no, I had trouble getting into... trying to figure out who he was talking to.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And once I kind of let that go, I was like, okay, there's things that are hilarious. Mm. And again, there's a little bit of that engagement with, like, time being... you know, a non-issue in America, you know, and in particularly in California, to kind of see erasures of history and things like that. He talks about that in a really cool way. That's an interesting, mm-hmm. because audience is, I mean, that book, did it win the National Book Award?
Booker, got the book.
Oh, the
book.
Booker. It wasn't? Yeah, it was.
No, it's the only, no, first time it came out. It's the only American novel, I think, to win the Man Booker Prize. That's my understanding. What at least
just allowed American books to be considered.
Yeah. All I know is that I never see funny books nominated for anything. And I was like, okay, we can now, you know, understand that humor is literary.
I liked that. Paul Bettany's not here, right?
Hi, I have a question for Ishmael. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the writers who were writing around the same time as you, that you felt that they were very brutal towards each other as opposed to writers who might be writing a few years or maybe a generation later. Mm-hmm. Looking back, why do you think that was? I maybe have an idea, but I'm very curious.
There's a lot of pressure on us because there was no way that we could beat our enemies in the street. They had the firepower, and so we turned on each other. And we put too much hope in Malcolm X, who was a friend of mine, incidentally. I'm 100 years old. I wrote a poem for him entitled Fanfare for the Avenging Angel. It was so bad I threw it away. But he was very charitable. He said, you know, it reminds him of Virgil and Dante. And he had read more in prison than what was on our curriculum at a university. So we thought that there would be a physical confrontation and that this thing would be over and there'd be a revolution. And it didn't happen. So, you know, people turned on each other. People in our group, Umbra Magazine, which was... which became the cradle for Black Arts Movement. If you read Amir Rocker's books and his literature, he will say that Black Arts came out of Umbra. We were downtown. But some of the people in Umbra went uptown to form the Black Arts Repertory Theater, and there was a shooting. I mean, just, you know, one of the people in Umbra shot a critic. So, shot Larry Neal. So that's what happened. I think that's what happens with all, you know, if you outnumber.
Yeah.
And they have this guy, Mad Dog Madigan, the sheriff, he said it precisely. He said after the riots in Berkeley over the free speech movement and the People's Park, he said they can't do this in the streets. We taught them that. So... that's the problem in this country, is that we're like, you know, in chains in terms of trying to, you know, take on our enemies. And it's going to get worse because you have a fascist racist in the White House. I don't know, the Democrats don't seem to have any bite to, you know, to fight back, right? So that's the problem you have here. So we turn on each other.
Hi, thank you both so much. I'm wondering if there are books that you wish were no longer taught or books that you wish were taught, books you would recommend to a teacher.
I think Jubilee by Margaret Walker. She spent 30 years on that book. And it has chapters devoted to the slavery period, Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction, Civil War. Her stuff on the Civil War is so good, it's like written by a military expert or something. This is a black woman living in Mississippi, and I used that book at California College of the Arts, and it really opened my eyes to stuff. So I think that Margaret Walker's Jubilee is, I would recommend that book. And I would recommend Louise Merriweather's Daddy Was a Number Runner. Another excellent book. I think she's in her 90s now. She's like the grand dame of black letters. She doesn't get very much publicity because her take on... Now, they both wrote about the same region, about the same area, Harlem. And I think Baldwin avoids a lot of the political stuff. It's a very religious book. It's all about conversion, thrashing on the thrashing floor, and those biblical metaphors and everything. It's all about a young man who eventually abandons the church and becomes secular, which sort of matches his. But Louise Merriweather takes on the conditions in Harlem, the riots, the absentee landlords, the whole problem, the police brutality, that whole period of, people coming from the South and settling in Harlem and being pushed around by the police and different authorities. So I would recommend that book, Daddy Was a Number Runner. And anything by Gwendolyn Brooks. Gwendolyn Brooks, anything by her. Of course, she didn't get the kind of reception the Tokens got because she abandoned them. She thumbed her nose at the establishment and went black and started publishing with a black publisher. Mm-hmm. She got a Pulitzer Prize, left it, abandoned it.
She died broke.
No, she didn't die broke.
I thought she did. No, she was broke when she...
She was a middle class.
Someone said,
She won the Pulitzer.
When she won the Pulitzer, someone told me that, she couldn't pay her electric bill or something. I don't know.
No, she became an icon in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is there a collected edition of her poetry?
Not that I know of.
No. I mean, she wasn't broke. She gave me $2,000.
Listen, she came
she
up then.
She gave me a grant. She sort of like ruled Chicago toward the end of her life. So,
but why did it take her so long? It's crazy.
Well, take us so long. I don't understand.
I guess to get that kind of... clout.
Well, it's very difficult. As a matter of fact, what's his name? Who's an unreadable guy? This is a famous white poet. I can't figure his name right now. But anyway, when she won the Pulitzer Prize, he said, "Who let the skunk into the establishment?" Stevens. Wallace Stevens. I published Bonnie Parker's poems. You know her work? Bonnie Parker? Bonnie Parker? You know her work? Anybody heard of Bonnie Parker's poetry? Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie Parker wrote poetry. The Saga of Suicide Sounds. So I put out the question on Facebook, who has done more for American poetry, Bonnie Parker or Wallace Stevens? And this professor says, you give me something to think about all day.
And Morgan?
I don't know. I co-sign, I guess. I'm really bad with the random book suggestion questions. But.
Read Black Reconstruction too. That's key. Black Reconstruction by W. Du Bois.
Yeah.
He took that book to Hollywood, and tried to get Daryl Zanuck to base the Civil War movie on Black Reconstruction. That book, and what we got was Gone with the Wind. This hymn to the Confederacy, which is like Hamilton. We're supposed to sympathize with all the people in the big house. Hamilton wanted a monarchy. Did you know that? You realize that, right? That Alexander Hamilton wanted a monarchy. an elected monarchy. One king dies, you elect another one, right? So we sort of sympathize with all the people in the big house and their problems. I said the only difference is at least the slave has speaking parts,
yes,
and God
true,
with the wind,
true.
Right? So you
that's
know.
True. And that was our big gift.
And she took over that script. People put down Hattie McDaniel. The script called for a shuffling mammy. She took that thing over. She became the CEO of that movie, ordering everybody around, putting them in their place. So she did a lot with the script. So I never put down Hattie McDaniel.
We have time for one more.
I admire your courage as an inspiration for other for writers, all writers, to try to continue to write and what is the truth. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think this is a very important point you're making. Talent is common, okay? It's not something that belongs to an elite or people of privilege. It's common. When I go to Japan, people in Japan, everybody writes a tanka. From the cab driver all the way up to the royal family, you know? That's what you guys should do. You know, write about your experience. I saw that cab driver. We were coming in from Detroit. And this woman was like, looked like the cab. She lived in it. You know, stuff was all around her. She was obese and all the things. You know what I mean? She started talking about the fall and the spring and the different seasons. Remember? And I said, you have to put that down on paper. You have the poet's talent. And she said, I'm going to do that. I'm going to write a poem every day. So all of you, if you want some inexpensive psychotherapy, right? You know, poetry will direct you immediately to your soul. Mm-hmm. That's different than poetry and prose. Mm-hmm. So all of you should write poetry. Don't go out and read other people's stuff. You know, women didn't think they could write. They were buying books by men, right? You remember what Norman Mailer said? Would you recall what Norman Mailer said? Twat can't write. You remember what Allen Ginsberg said? It's not our fault that women didn't produce any geniuses. You know? Women changed that. They buy each other's books, you know? So the average person, all of you, average or not, you should try writing poetry.
And with that, please join me in thanking Ishmael and Morgan for this conversation.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.